This week on our show, we have Steve Yarbrough, who is the author of 9 books. His most recent novel, The Realm of Last Chances, was recently published by Knopf. He has been a finalist for the Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters, and he has won the Massachusetts Book Award. His 2006 novel, The End of California, also by Knopf, was also a finalist for the Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters Award. Welcome to our show, Steve.
It's an honor to talk to you guys.
You know, I was telling Ben earlier that when I had a radio show at Fresno State for a little time, you were the first guest I had on.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah, you hadn't had a novel yet. You had just a one collection of stories, Family Man, which I still have on my shelf today. And you read a story from the Best American Stories of, you know, whatever year it was at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, and look, they put your story last because they saved the best for the last. And you go, Dan, it's alphabetized.
You were being kind.
Well, you know, you've always been one of my mentors, one of my favorite writers, and one of my favorite people. And I am really excited about The Realm of Last Chances. And this is what number novel from Knopf?
It's, let's see, it's the 5th novel that I've done with Knopf, and it's my 6th novel overall.
Wow, and it's a wonderful story about, well, there's a lot of characters, but I guess we could say that it focuses on Kristen, Cal, and Matt. And it's also a breakthrough novel for you in the sense that it's the first novel that I know of, I think I've read most of yours, that doesn't take place in the South.
Yeah, it is. I kind of felt like I needed a break from Mississippi. and when I moved up here, I found myself falling in love with the landscape, and it just felt like, you know, it was something I wanted to write about.
You know, what's interesting is when you were in California, you were in Fresno for, I don't know, 10 years or so. But when you were in California, oftentimes you would write something set in California, but it would be a Southern character in California. This time, it doesn't even seem that you have any Southern characters. Your Cal is from California. I don't remember where Christian's from, but Matt is from the East Coast. Did that feel weird for you?
Initially, it did. But I felt like I knew Cal. I knew guys like Cal during the time I was in Central Valley. And by the way, Daniel, your clock has been kind to me. I was actually out there for 21 years.
You were? Oh, my gooseness.
Yeah. Wow. So I felt like I got to know people in the valley. And Kristen is from a little town in Pennsylvania. Mm. Oddly enough, I've spent a lot of time in Pennsylvania, so I felt like I knew that environment. And Matt is from a town like the one I lived in, so I felt pretty secure with those three, other than, you know, just the general fear that you feel every day when you sit down and look at a blank screen.
Right. Well, Cal is for me, I really like Cal's character. One of the characteristics that Cal has that strikes me is he always carries his Bosey speaker everywhere he goes, so he could listen to his music, and he always strums at his guitar and drinks his whiskey. And you know what? I couldn't help but see a little bit of you in Cal.
Well, I've been told that before. You know, I guess the point of departure is that the other thing Cal does is he does construction for a living. And I'm one of those people who honestly cannot even handle a hammer or a screwdriver.
Oh, that surprises me.
Yeah, so I had to imagine that part of his character.
You were one of my first and second fiction workshop that I had ever took. And so even now in my graduate seminars, I sometimes channel you. But one of the things that you taught us is how important it is to research the facts of what your characters are into. Cal knows everything. Cal can walk into a home. He could tell what kind of wood floors they are, whether or not they were put in correctly. I mean, he knows the house. Did you have to do research on that specifically for this book? How did you know all that stuff?
Well, yeah, I did have to do some. My dad, if he couldn't build it, he really couldn't have it. so he did a lot of work on houses, and he was useful to me, but then he's never been up here in New England, so he really couldn't quite imagine what an old New England house would look like. Mm-hmm. As luck would have it, I noticed that there's a guy living down the street. I think he's since moved away, who had a sign on his door saying that he did construction. And I had him over one day, and we had a little whiskey, and I told him I needed some help. And I said, I'd like you to walk through my house and tell me what you would notice if you were walking into this house for the first time. And, he walked through it, and he said a lot of the things that Cal says in the novel. Mm. So that was kind of my research, a little bit of whiskey and a lot of talk.
That's nice. Steve, what got you into writing to begin with?
Well, when I was growing up, my family were small-time farmers in Mississippi, and I could tell that life was really hard for them. They didn't own much land, and they worked all day and would just come in half dead at night. So I knew that there was nothing wrong with that life except that I didn't want it. And I first wanted to be a musician, and I figured out I wasn't quite good enough to be professional. And I played football for a while and got, college scholarship. But again, I wasn't going to be good enough to go on. And the only other thing I'd always loved was reading. So when I was about 18 or 19, people asked me, what are you going to do? I started saying, I'm going to be a writer. And I really didn't know anything about what it took to be a writer. But when I got to college, I met some people who were helpful. A professor named Evans Harrington had written one novel when he was a young man. And then I met Willie Morris, who had been editor of Harper's Magazine and had written several books. And they both told me that they saw some talent, but that I was going to have to work really hard. And so that's what I did. I just sat down and started writing horrible stuff. But after a while, it began to get a little bit better, and I could stand to read it.
Did you go on to get a MFA?
I did get an MFA at the University of Arkansas, and I was fortunate because I had good teachers. I had a man named John Clellan Holmes, who had been one of Jack Kerouac's best friends, and actually I think John wrote the first Beat novel. William Harrison was important to me, a novelist and screenwriter who had had quite a few successes. And then I had classes. I was in a class at least twice, I think, with John Dufresne and Lee Martin. And those two guys, between them now, have probably published about 21 or 22 books. So I had good people to learn from, and not just the teachers, but the other students as well.
Were you well-versed in Southern literature?
When I went to college, and I went to Ole Miss, so it was the town that William Faulkner was from. Mm-hmm. That's the first time I had read Southern writers. And I went through a huge Faulkner phase, and I still think Faulkner was probably, all things considered, our greatest novelist. Read a lot of Flannery O'Connor, read Eudora Welty a little bit later. But by and large, my favorite writers have never been Southern writers.
Mm-hmm. Who had they been?
I read a lot of Eastern European writers, and people think that I've been doing that because I'm married to a woman from Poland, but in fact, I started reading those writers before I met her.
Maybe that's why you're married to a woman from Poland, the other way around.
Well, she was the first Polish person I'd ever met, and I walked right over to her and asked her, what do you think of Tadeusz Konwicki? And she almost dropped dead, partly because of the way that word sounded when it came out of my mouth, I suspect. But I read a lot of Eastern Europeans, and still do. Read a lot of Irish writers. Read a lot of Latin American writers. So I think that probably served me well because, those writers from the South, especially Faulkner and O'Connor, they're so distinctive that imitating them is perilous, it seems to me.
Right. Very perilous.
Yeah, in fact, when I first started writing, I was in your class, and I wrote I wrote a story that you had to say, Danny, let Faulkner be Faulkner.
Did I say that?
Yeah, you did.
Well, it wasn't bad advice.
No, it wasn't. I still think of that to this day. Let's get back to the novel. Matt is a very interesting character. He's incredibly literate. He loves to read. He used to work in a bookstore, but he has, you know, this past that, of course, I'm not going to give too much away because it's a very interesting past. In fact, all your characters, all three of them, have very interesting secrets that come out towards the end of the novel. But he first meets Kristen, who is married to Cal, and who is going to be an administrator at a job at a university over there on the East Coast. But he notices her because she's wearing a Kundera T-shirt, which I think is very funny. And he goes on and on about Kundera. How did that come about? Do you read a lot of Kundera? And how does that detail play into the whole novel?
Well, yeah, I did read a lot of Kundera, and I have some opinions about Kundera's work that are pretty similar to those expressed by Matt.
Mm. It sounded very authentic, his marking a particular period when Kundera didn't do as well as his earlier books.
Yeah, when he started writing in French. I happen to feel that, as Matt does, that that's not his best work, mm-hmm. and that the texture of the fiction thins out, but it was just an inspiration. I wanted a literary connection between them, and I don't know if I ever saw a T-shirt with Kundera's face on it, and the legend Kundera rocks or not, but I could have. It's possible. Yeah. And then, you know, that sets up the next reference to another Eastern European writer who becomes a connection between the two of them, and that's the Hungarian Sándor Márai.
And that's the novelist the novel he lends to Kristen.
Right. A book called Embers, which is right in front of me here.
Oh, wow.
On the top of the bookcase in my study. It's a book that my wife kept telling me, you have to read this. And I never heard of Márai. He committed suicide in San Diego, I believe, in 1988, and his work was discovered by a Knopf editor, Carol Brown Janeway, in the 90s. And she translated this novel, not from Hungarian, but from the German. And I remember, I think I was at the Southern Festival of Books in Nashville, and I bent over the wrong way in the hotel and hurt my back. Mm. And I had this novel with me because my wife had said, basically, if you don't read this, we're going to have trouble. And I spent all of a Saturday afternoon lying on the floor on my back reading this novel, and it just absolutely devastated me.
Wow.
When I read it. The connection to a long-lost friend and a long-lost love.
Wow.
It's powerful. And that became a sort of controlling theme in the novel that I wrote.
You know that saying, the devil is in the details, God is in the details. There's this wonderful scene where Kristen, and we kind of know that something's going to happen between her and Matt.
Mm-hmm.
We sense it right from the beginning. But there's this wonderful scene where she's looking at the book on her nightstand. It's right next to her bed. And just the way it kind of, I don't know, disturbs her a bit somehow. It takes away her peace somehow just looking at that book. It's that detail just really foreshadows and contains a lot of the energy and the tension between them. It's a wonderful detail.
Well, thank you. I think she's a character who, like the old general in Embers, the way she's dealt with something painful from her past is just to try to erase it from her memory. But erasing something from your memory is not an easy thing to do.
I want to ask you a little bit about your use of point of view. There's many characters in here, and the point of view is omniscient in such a way even that sometimes when we're rooted in one character, the reader can see something that the character doesn't see. But you have this short passage that I want to read when all three of the characters come together for the first time. And you do something really interesting with the point of view that I notice you do a lot in your short stories, too. And I've tried to steal this from you many, many times unsuccessfully. But they're all meeting for the first time. And then the sentence says, though each of them in the months ahead would recall the exact remark differently, all three noted that his initial reaction upon seeing them together was to assume disaster had struck.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful use of point of view. It doesn't really come out of the story, but it kind of, it's a, oh my God, there's going to be something that's going to happen between these three people.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you two writers who have influenced me a lot with point of view, and sometimes, especially with the first of these, it's not even so much his handling of point of view as it is his ability to constantly vary the distance between us and the characters. And that's the Irish writer, William Trevor, especially in his short stories, but in his novels as well. He's constantly shifting the ground under your feet. And another writer, a Texas writer actually, very different kind of writer, but Larry McMurtry, is also, he plays fast and loose with perspective. And you can see it in, you know, in a novel like Lonesome Dove, where both of those writers are refreshingly free from having a lot of rules imposed on them by creative writing workshops.
Right.
So I just decided at a certain point I was going to make up my own rules for everything that I write, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
We're going to be winding up here, but I wanted to tell a story about you. Or I wanted to say something about you. Do you know that to this day, when I go into a bookstore I've never been in, and sometimes even some I've not been in, and I walk the aisles, I think of you. I feel you. I feel your presence, because when you were my professor, your first book had just come out, Family Man.
Right.
And you were very excited about it. I mean, I think you were hired because of that book. And I remember I was in the bookstore at Fresno State, and I was a new writer. I was very excited, and I just wanted to look through books. But I saw you. And if you've never seen Steve Yarbrough, he's an incredibly tall man. And back then, you had hair almost all the way down to your butt. It was long, long hair. And you were probably only in your late 20s, I would imagine, or mid-20s. But I saw you walking around and passing by where they had your books. And you were just kind of like looking at them out of the corner of your eye. And I thought, oh, man, that is so beautiful. Because I saw that you were a new writer. And I didn't even know, you know, what it was like to be a writer, but a new writer seeing your books on the shelf probably for the first time, and it was a really exciting moment for you.
Yeah, it was, and that really hasn't changed for me. When I go in a bookstore, and I'm in a bookstore every few days, you know, somewhere,
right.
I always look, you know, I look to see if they're there, and sometimes they're there, and they'll be beside a some of Richard Yates's novels. And, you know, he was a big inspiration to
me. Oh, that's awesome.
It always makes me happy.
Yeah, it's because of you I read Richard Yates, but I do the same thing. And thank you very much for appearing on our show, Steve Yarbrough.
Yes, thanks, Steve, for being on Words on a Wire.
And please pick up his novel, The Realm of Last Chances, by Knopf, still in hardback, and wonderful story. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, guys.